What happens if Putin uses a so-called low-yield weapon in Ukraine? You know, there are people who spent a long time in this business who are really fearful about the fact that a nuclear weapon may be used on a modern battlefield. I don't know that everybody really understands that when it comes to nuclear weapons, we have a nuclear monarchy. You know, those weapons are essentially the president's weapons. This is all happening at the same time that nuclear nations are investing and expanding their nuclear arsenals.
Hey, welcome back to the Modern War Institute podcast. I'm John Ambo, editorial director at MWI, and this episode features a conversation about nuclear weapons, which is the focus of a New York Times series that just launched called At the Brink. The series sets out to explore a range of issues, specifically the risk of nuclear war, how we have navigated that risk historically, and what will be required to do so in the future. Now, this is obviously a huge subject with wide-ranging scope. There is, of course, the science underpinning these weapons. There are policy challenges to consider and questions of strategy. There are important historical and scholarly perspectives, and there are issues of both international and domestic politics. This series, At the Brink, brings elements of all of these together. Its lead writer is W.J. Hennigan. He actually goes by Bill, and he joins me on this episode. Before we get to the discussion, a couple notes. First, if you're not yet subscribed to the MWI podcast, you can find it on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Bill Hennigan. Bill, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the MWI podcast.
My pleasure.
So you are a reporter, a journalist, and you work for the New York Times, and I believe you joined the New York Times last summer, was it? August 2023, I think I saw it was when the announcement was made.
That's correct.
And that announcement, it mentioned that you were joining to lead a project that it described as an ambitious department-wide series on nuclear threats and the challenges our world faces combating proliferation. That series has now launched. It's called At the Brink. The first article, really the first piece of content, I think, is out. I hesitate to call it an article because it's more in-depth and multimedia-based than just black text on a white background that we're sort of used to consuming. I want to kind of start from the beginning. Can you tell me how this project came about? And you know, you've covered a pretty wide range of security and defense-related issues in your career as a journalist. So I'm curious, what drew you to the project?
Yeah, thanks. So as you say, I've covered national security issues for 15 years. I started covering the aerospace and defense industries for the Los Angeles Times from Los Angeles, and then I was a Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and went on to work for Time Magazine covering similar issues. And the New York Times approached me about this ambitious series that they wanted to do, because I've covered a range of issues in journalism pertaining to the U.S. military, but kind of my niche has always been nuclear weapons. I've always looked for opportunities to write about them and to work alongside service members in the Air Force and Navy that work in this realm. And they knew that they kind of had a notional idea of that they wanted to do something because of the way the geopolitics surrounding this issue. The trajectory is not good. The arms control measures that were made in during the Cold War have either sunsetted or they're being walked away from, and this is all happening at the same time that nuclear nations are investing and expanding their nuclear arsenals. So, once I was hired, then we started, whittling that down and thinking about a series of stories that would be the best to articulate that the topic and the ecosystem around nuclear weapons for our readers.
That's obviously it's a big subject, right? We want to do a series about nuclear weapons that can go in so many different directions and incorporate so many different perspectives, from the science behind it to the strategic calculus surrounding it to the policy questions of counterproliferation. How did you initially sort of scope out the limitations that you wanted to impose on it to give yourself sort of left and right limits and know what you wanted to tackle?
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it, right? It's you have to pick your shots, and you also want to make sure that you're picking the right people to tell that story through. It's a difficult thing, but it's also, that's my job as a journalist to identify both the subject matter and the people that are the best to convey that. So, you know, I should say that this is still a work in progress in some regard. You know, we did launch the first story. We have the second going tomorrow, and we have others down the line that we know we're going to do. But as you know, as news events happen, we're going to, you know, tailor the news coverage, tailor our coverage off of the news coverage to make it as timely as we can for people, to tie it to current events. And, you know, with the launch of the first story, for instance, only 2 days earlier, Vladimir Putin was out there threatening nuclear warfare. So it just happened to be a confluence of news events there.
You mentioned the second piece will go live tomorrow. By the time listeners hear this, that will probably be out already. I know you can just Google New York Times at the brink. You're going to find the first piece. You're going to find the second piece. So I encourage listeners to do so, because I really, really enjoyed the perspectives that were sort of shared in the first piece. I want to talk about that first piece because it sort of opens by describing actions taken in 2022, right? Russia had just invaded Ukraine. There were fears that Russia might use a tactical nuclear weapon if Ukraine made significant battlefield advances, particularly surrounding Crimea. As you point out in the piece, a U.S. assessment, an intelligence community assessment, put the odds at like 50-50 that that might happen. Can you describe kind of, I guess, what sort of activities that kind of assessment triggers? You know, if estimates are that this is a realistic possibility, how does the U.S. government respond? How did it respond? How did Ukraine respond and Ukraine's European neighbors?
Right. So when I was told about that assessment, I basically fell out of my chair. I mean, I know that Russia's defense of Crimea is substantial, and that the Ukrainian counteroffensive fell well short. But still, the idea that it could come down to a coin flip as to whether or not a nuclear weapon is used for the first time in 8 decades was floored me. And so, right, at that time, the American government really, particularly in the Biden administration, I mean, yeah, as we know, just to take a step back, the Biden administration has always been worried about escalation in this conflict throughout it, right? And so the critics have said, you know, overly so, you know, almost paralyzing in terms of what weaponry they're willing to provide. But when this occurred, the U.S. government, almost all arms of the U.S. government snapped into action. So I was told that the State Department ensured that, you know, radiation monitoring equipment, equipment from the NNSA or under the Department of Energy, you know, they forwarded equipment to capture any irradiated debris from a possible nuclear weapon being used. They were also able to provide remote sensing capabilities back to the United States in the national labs here, so that U.S. scientists could monitor in real time whether there were any aberrations in radiation detecting. There was a series of shipments that were made in a hurry to Ukraine in that fall timeframe.
Can you talk about you also write about the Tiger Team, I believe it was called in the piece. Can you talk about its role in this sort of crisis management, nuclear crisis management, if we can call it that?
Yeah. So just days after the initial invasion, you know, Jake Sullivan ordered the NSC to formulate what they call a Tiger Team. And your listeners might be familiar with this. This is senior officials from the intelligence, military, scientific community to take a deep dive and look at, you know, U.S. policy, U.S. deterrence policy strategy, and how to apply lessons that we haven't thought about in quite a time, or at least not at the forefront of American policy, and apply them to Ukraine. So over the period of months, you know, they developed this playbook of what to do in different scenarios. You know, if a tactical weapon was used, if a tactical weapon or a dirty bomb was used, you know, so they try to game out various scenarios and be able to provide the present. So say this happens, you know, these are the things, this is the diplomatic effort that we should push. This is this is the humanitarian effort that needs to go forward. These are the allies that we need to reach out to. So it was an ambitious thing and a, you know, quite a foresight that the NSC had in the early days of the invasion in 22.
But was that planning, I guess, did it sort of come into being as a response tool? Planning for a response, or is a how do we deter something like this? Because, you know, you mentioned tactical nuclear weapons, right? And I think it's really important that the listeners understand what we're talking about when we do that. These are relatively small, relatively low yield weapons, specifically intended for battlefield use. And these have been around a long time. During the Cold War, the Soviets fielded them. So did the United States. The U.S. Army had, I believe it was the W-54 or Mark 54, colloquially known as a backpack bomb, because it could literally be fit into a duffel bag. And the idea and vision for its battlefield use was, look, the Warsaw Pact can marshal substantially numerically larger conventional forces than NATO can. And so this is perhaps a tool that can be used to block Soviet axes of advance in the event of an invasion, right? What I think is really important there is that the Army was planning for use of this sort of outside of the strategic context of deterrence, because these were low yield and sort of existed below that conceptual threshold of when deterrence would come into play. How did that sort of factor into these considerations? Can you talk about the challenges that that category of weapons poses to deterrence?
Right. So everything that you said is absolutely correct. The one thing I will quibble with is, you know, we call them low yield, but it's kind of a misnomer, right? Because the largest explosive weapon that the U.S. military currently has is the GBU-43 MOAB, you know, mother of all bombs, that was used in Afghanistan. And that has a yield of 11 tons of TNT. And, you know, if you think about a low yield, and I'm putting in up air quotes here, tactical nuclear weapon, that it would have, you know, a half a kiloton, even a half a kiloton, that's 50 times larger than a conventional weapon. And that isn't even going into, you know, the radiation and all the rest of that. And indeed, you know, the United States, after the fall of the Soviet Union, pulled back all of its tactical weapons. And as you say, you know, they had artillery and they had depth charges and they had the backpack bomb. And all of those were pulled back after the fall of the Soviet Union. All that remains now are the B-61 airdropped weapons that are at various bases, roughly 100 of them or so, at bases in throughout Europe. But the Soviet Union, now Russia, never got rid of their tactical weapons. You know, the U.S. intelligence community believes they have up to 2,000 of these devices, you know, in all of in various forms, of course. And so one of the things that has come up from readers, you know, particularly in the nuclear space, is like, okay, Bill, why didn't you use a strategic warhead? Why didn't you why don't you describe what would happen if an H-bomb was used, you know, with megatons, not kilotons, but megatons. And the answer I have is number one, I go where the reporting takes me. Everybody was in the governments of both Ukraine and the U.S. government was telling me the fear was of a smaller device, of a single kiloton type of device. And the second answer that I have is, you know, a tactical nuclear weapon is a very challenging thing to deter against. What I mean by that is that it's not a city busting weapon that would demand the United States respond in kind, but nor is it a conventional response. So it's kind of it's crossing the nuclear taboo, but it's doing so in a way that it's just, you know, getting a toe or so across the line. And so and people can imagine that a little bit more. I think it's more realistic, you know, because of the wars that we've lived through over the past several years. You know, we can imagine this sort of hellish landscape. And you know, the other challenge is there. We are providing support for Ukraine, of course, but they are not a treaty ally of ours, and they are not a member of NATO. So what happens if Putin uses a so-called low yield weapon in Ukraine? The United States probably would not respond in kind and have a nuclear response, but it would have to do something. And so, you know, these are sort of the things that we were thinking through as we were putting the scenario together.
And in your conversations, you know, what is that something? Because I think it's, you know, it's important to note in, I believe it was March 2022, when these fears were really high, we published a piece of analysis by the director of the Air Force's Center for Strategic Deterrence Studies, who is sort of an expert on this, specifically the policy issues surrounding it from a Russian perspective. They do not have a no first use policy. Russian military doctrine does envisage a place for this when certain battlefield conditions are met. If those battlefield conditions were met, say next year, and this happened, is your sense that U.S. policymakers really have a good grasp of the tools in the toolkit to respond?
As we discussed earlier about the playbook, that's what that whole thing was about, was about gaming out exactly, you know, the various contingencies and how to respond. You know, no U.S. official gave me definitive answers about the precise way that they would respond. And I understand that was the, you know, they've in dealing with the Russians, they also kept it vague. I mean, that's part of the gamesmanship and the brinksmanship of when it comes to nuclear weapons is to leave, you know, some mystery in the minds of your adversary as to exactly how you're going to respond. But you know, the sort of things that I've had over the various discussions that I've had over these past several months is that, you know, think about, you know, the Black Sea, for instance, the Black Sea fleet and the Russian vessels there, you know, a strike, perhaps sinking the entire fleet. Another thing that was brought up was the newly installed weapons in tactical nuclear weapons, the Iskanders in Belarus, you know, an attack on those assets would provide it would provide the U.S. with a little coverage in terms of you're not crossing the tripwire of launching into Russian territory, but you are targeting their nuclear forces in a way that would hurt them. And you know, also this is not, it's not just the United States here. I mean, you know, there is a strong it's still a very strong taboo, not crossing the nuclear line there. So, you know, China, India, these nations also reached out to Russia to explain to them, you know, that it wouldn't, it's not just a military response. This would be an economic and diplomatic response that would hurt them in the long term. And that's what really deterrence comes down to, right? Is that, you know, you want your adversary to know that if they do this thing, you know, they're going to be hurt more than they're going to gain in doing it.
I think, you know, especially those two nations, India and China, right? That's got to be pretty compelling from Moscow's perspective, given those are the sort of two outlets that are keeping the sanctions regime that has been put in place from having maximum bite, because they're still able to purchase things that they need from both India and from China. When those countries reached out, when other countries reached out, is it your sense that that was part of a coordinated plan that the U.S. government said, hey, let's work with allies, partners, on, you know, and third countries that are not allies or partners to try to sort of generate this diplomatic momentum toward convincing Moscow this is not a good idea?
Precisely. And that was again, an outcropping of this playbook, which was, you know, we need everybody to articulate exactly what the withering consequences will be if you cross this line. And all of these states have a vested interest in maintaining, you know, non-nuclear use. Not only are the two that China and India nuclear powers themselves, but they're, you know, major economic powers in the world, and rising powers at that. So, you know, the idea of a nuclear weapon being used would have, you know, a cascading domino effect in the economic system for all sorts of reasons. And, you know, when they reached out, you know, and as you saw later in the G20 comment statement that was issued, you know, it was made clear to Russia that this is not something that's in their interest to pull off.
How do you think we should best conceptualize the degree of threat at any given moment, right? You describe the pretty high threat environment in 2022. You acknowledge that it's a bit lower now. We have things like, you know, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, Doomsday Clock, but that's sat for the past 2 years at 90 seconds to midnight. There's not a whole lot of wiggle room to push it closer to midnight. Are there ways that we can generate kind of a consensus view of how serious the threat is at any given moment?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is the first time, I've covered this issue for a number of years, but this is the first time in my, you know, journalistic career that I've ever had U.S. officials explain to me that, you know, they were having sleepless nights over this. You know, and almost always nuclear use is described in like these abstract terms. And I think for me, that's what was so startling about this was the fact that, you know, there were people who spent a long time in this business who are really fearful about the fact that a nuclear weapon may be used on a modern battlefield. And so I think that period was really tense, but, you know, Ukraine ultimately was halted. And that's the paradox of this conflict throughout, which is, you know, when Ukraine is doing well, that's when the threat of nuclear use rises. And when Russia is doing well, and as they are taking territory currently, the nuclear threat lowers. And so I think, you know, when it comes to Ukraine, it's vastly different than it was 2 years ago. When you take a step back and look at the broader picture, though, I think, you know, and this was said several times to me, that this is the most dangerous time since the end of the Cold War when it comes to nuclear issues. Because, you know, not only do you have leaders trying to coerce their regional neighbors with nuclear use, you know, they're also testing these sort of novel systems. You know, if you look at a nation like North Korea, they've evolved their capabilities so much over the last decade or so, and you know, it's kind of eye-watering to see the amount of the arsenal that they've been able to build up. I mean, now they even have technical nuclear weapons themselves. And so, you know, we have that's what's a different element here than it was in the first Cold War, which is, you know, there are so many different nations that have a nuclear capability, and also, you know, in areas of the world where, you know, the next conflict might tick off, right? Because the Cold War was, you know, largely fought through proxy wars, but they, you know, in South America, or but you know, it never kind of resulted in a large scale war in on the continent of Europe, like we have today. And, you know, with the issue with China and its, you know, intent to take Taiwan by force if necessary. I mean, again, a nuclear component. Iran, you know, Iran is expanding its nuclear program. It hasn't decided to build a weapon, but it could within a matter of days. It could have the right amount of nuclear fissile material. So, you know, I think that, you know, when we look ahead here, you know, it's a very dangerous time. This is also taking place in a vacuum where there's just no diplomacy moving forward. No nation is interested in talking about nuclear reductions. You know, throughout most of our lives, we've been living through a time of repeated nuclear reductions. You know, not more weapons, but less. And the number of safeguards of various treaties, you know, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement, for instance, which eliminated a whole class of mid-range missiles from the United States and Russia, that's now gone. So these various checks that we once had and agreements, they've all fallen by the wayside. And the only one that's left now is New START. And that caps the number of deployed strategic weapons to 1550 from the United States and Russia. But I, you know, I could say through my conversations, I mean, that's in name only, really, that this treaty, all of the robust verification measures that were established of, like, being able for Russia to send their people here and the Americans to send our people to their nuclear facilities for inspections, that doesn't occur anymore. There's no strategic stability talks about, you know, follow-on agreements. We basically have to take one another's word for it on how many strategic weapons that are deployed. And I recognize, you know, there's a robust intelligence gathering capabilities on both sides to make sure that that's true. But, you know, as I end the article on the Nuclear Risk Reduction Center at the State Department, you know, this place used to be abuzz with a number of messages being passed back and forth between Russia and the United States about the maintenance work that they were going to do. Hey, you may see a crew here. We're going to go do some maintenance work on this ICBM silo, you know, our bomber, you know, these sort of various messages that would be passed back and forth are no longer happen. And, you know, this may seem to be trivial, but, you know, When you have information like that, it helps you build out an intelligence picture. And in the absence of that, you know, every nation has to think about their own national defense first and foremost. You know, something that might be a routine maintenance check could be misinterpreted. And that's the real fear here looking forward, is in the absence of all this arms control and diplomatic communications going back and forth, we're leaving ourselves open to some sort of mishap or miscalculation in the future.
And if that infrastructure, right, that arms control infrastructure is sort of expiring, I guess, for lack of a better term, you know, in order to build it up in place in the first place, both sides had to be incentivized. All signatories need to be incentivized to do so. What incentives existed during that period, during the Cold War, when much of this infrastructure was established that no longer exists? Why? Is it just more, I guess, more cavalier attitude towards brinksmanship? What is it?
It was fear, mutual fear on both sides is what motivated them to come together, to identify weapons that were, you know, mutually menacing and then eliminate them or at least try to reduce the risk. I think that what's happened over the last generation is that we've not had that fear. We've not, in part because of the benefits wrought by arms control agreements, this has not loomed over our heads in a way. And also, you know, we had a pretty good relationship with Russia up until about, 15 years ago, maybe even less than that. And so, there was no imminent concern about, weapons being used. But now, we're at such at loggerheads when it comes to Ukraine that it's hard to imagine us, coming back to the table and having, hammering out these diplomatic deals. And, the thing about arms control is that it's iterative. You have to build trust, and that trust was built over a series of decades, right? You take one kernel of an agreement, and then that would expand to another one. And so, I think, talking to people that dedicate their whole careers to this, is that we're going to have to enter an era of open competition before we are able to, before that fear sets in once again, and we're able to, have a reapproach arms control for the 21st century. That's a pretty scary thing to look at, considering that, when you look back in the history books, it was almost, a cataclysm came down to a low-level officer making the right decision. Getting it right every time is, an impossibility. We're human after all.
You have been working on this series for a number of months now, probably every day, talking to people, right? A pretty diverse set of stakeholders, people with widely divergent perspectives on this. You're talking about policymakers, academic scholars, scientists, what have you. You mentioned that your jaw sort of dropped when you heard that 50-50 intelligence assessment about the likelihood of a tactical nuclear weapon use by Russia in 2022. Is there anything else that has really shocked you or surprised you as you've been doing this reporting?
I think there's I mentioned it briefly, it's just the lack of momentum when it comes to arms control. Considering that, we've had a time of relative peace when it comes to, near peer competitors. And the fact that there is such a lack of interest, I've read a lot about this issue over the years, and the fact that we're having these discussions again is just stunning. I wouldn't say that the entire problem posed by nuclear weapons was solved, but to a large extent it was contained. And if we're talking about growing arsenals again, and there's no discussion yet in the United States. I mean, here and there you'll hear a little bit about it, but there's no discussion yet, serious conversation about expanding the nuclear arsenal beyond the 1550 that we currently have deployed on our triad. But you have to imagine, if you look down the line, there are going to be hawks that say, and have a good argument to say, hey, look at Russia and China, what they're doing. We need to have as many weapons as them combined in order to properly deter them. Whether or not you agree with that argument, you have to acknowledge the fact that, it's likely going to be made. And I think when you think about, when you take a step back and say, hey, where are we headed here? And all of this is happening, of course, without a really robust conversation from the American public. I mean, there's just not, during the 80s, for instance, there was a mobilized citizenry. A million people were in New York City at Central Park to, for the nuclear freeze movement. It's the largest protest ever. And, how many people do you hear talking about nuclear weapons today? Very few of those conversations take place. Oppenheimer has kind of put this back into the zeitgeist a bit, and people are discussing that a little bit more. But, you know, I still think that people may know the broad contours of nuclear weapons, but they certainly don't know the details in a way that they might know climate change, for instance, and, you know, another existential issue over our globe.
Yeah, you know, I guess it is just it's a different thing entirely than it was for, say, our parents' generation, who grew up, you know, doing drills in school, and there were, it sort of touched people's lives in very real ways. I really like, there was a quote in the very introduction of this first piece. It said, "Nuclear war is often described as unimaginable. In fact, it's not imagined enough." And I think you could make the case that it was more so during the Cold War. It certainly was when there were these key inflection points, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis. The release of The Day After, right? This film in the 1980s. Why did what happened in 2022, this period of heightened risk, dramatically heightened risk, why did that not also maybe represent one of those inflection points where a lot more people were talking about it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the sort of cultural, elements, like, you know, you bring up these films, and there's also video games and songs, you know, 99 Red Balloons.
Yeah, yeah.
All of these things may seem small, but they're like, overall, this is part of the conversation going on in within that generation. So people are, there's a heightened awareness of it, and that hasn't existed. I think, you know, The fall of the Soviet Union contributed to it, of course, but then 9/11, you know, the terrorist threat eclipsed everything else. And so, you know, an entire generation came of age without really having to fear nuclear warfare in a way that our parents and grandparents did. And that's one of the things that have come up since the story is published, is, you know, so many people have reached out to me to relay those stories and concerns that they may be coming back. I think the reason that it didn't sort of rise to the level that fall 22 period didn't rise to the level of you know, heightening those concerns is because there's so many distractions. People aren't as plugged into it. They're not as in tuned to you know, the nuclear risk as they were in those periods. And again, I think because it was, you know, there were so many films that were out during the time in the 80s that there were constant reminders of that this is something, you know, that we need to be aware of and fear. That just doesn't exist today.
What else does the series have in store? What do you have planned for future releases from it?
Yeah, as we discussed, we'll be publishing a story tomorrow about, you know, the president's sole authority to launch nuclear weapons. You know, I think this is particularly timely coming off of Super Tuesday results in the, you know, the likelihood that we're going to see a President Biden and Trump rematch. You know, here we have two of the oldest candidates ever in our nation's history running for office. And, you know, I don't know that everybody really understands that when it comes to nuclear weapons, we have a nuclear monarchy. You know, those weapons are essentially the president's weapons. Only the president can make that decision to use those weapons. And that's not any way that any other part of the military works. You know, there are all sorts of chain, you know, the chain of command is critical to almost any military decision-making process. And that's not the way that it works for nuclear weapons. And, you know, I think as we lay out in the story, you'll see, is, you know, when it comes to a nuclear counterattack, let's say, you know, that we do see an adversary launch an ICBM attack on our country, you know, that's a 30-minute flight time. And you know, basically that breaks down to about 15 minutes that the president has to make a decision on whether or not to counterattack, because, you know, we want to get our weapons away before they're eliminated by the incoming strike. And in 15 minutes, it's a tight time to make a world ending decision. And, you know, anybody who's married knows that, adding, whenever you decide to have dinner, you know, deciding with your spouse on what to eat is takes longer than 15 minutes. I do think that, you know, it probably is sensible that a president needs to have that sole authority in that regard. It would just, adding more people would just be seem more unnecessarily complicated to an already complicated problem. But no U.S. president, no person should be have the, you know, the unilateral authority to launch a nuclear strike. That is something that the United States Congress needs to step in and do. And there have been various efforts over the years to rectify that. But, you know, all those efforts, all those bills, and including one that's active now, they've all found, died in committee. So, you know, I think that this is before this election and the American public should demand and we urge Congress to act on this issue. It just makes common sense that there should be somebody else in the loop, whether or not that's a Senate ratified position like the Secretary of Defense or State or Joint Chiefs of Staff, or senior member of Congress, but anyway, there should have to be some consensus. There should have to be a consensus when it comes to launching a nuclear strike. It should not just be at the whims of one man or woman.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading that. Again, I highly encourage listeners to find this series. The first piece was exceptional. I look forward to reading the second piece and further content kind of produced under its remit going forward. I'm sure a lot of work has gone into it. You probably have a lot more work ahead of you as you continue this series. So best of luck with that. And thanks for joining me on the podcast.
It was my pleasure, John. Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing. If you aren't yet following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.